Welcome to Film Fight Club. I'm Glenn Falkenstein from Falcon Screen, and we are joined by Sydney filmmaker Chris Evans.
Hello, guys.
Freelance writer and critic Virat Nehru.
Hello, hello.
And we have a very special guest, the editor of The Real Bits and the author and world expert, actually, on The Green Arrow, and author of Moving Target, The History and Evolution of Green Arrow, Richard Gray. Richard, thank you so much for joining us.
Special guest. I could get used to that.
Yes.
Yeah, welcome back, Richard, actually, because we've had you before, but now you're more famous, so welcome back.
Thank you. No, pleasure to be back.
Huh? Always good to have you on the show.
It absolutely is. So we have a full house. We will be talking Richard's book shortly, but first, we are talking about the film of the week in cinemas, which opens tomorrow, which is Suburbicon. It is written by the Coen brothers. It is directed by George Clooney. And
also written by George
Clooney. Yes, also, it's an interesting backstory on this film. It's a Coen brothers script from 1986 that they wrote just after Blood Simple, and it has a kind of similar plot to Blood Simple in some ways, and it's been...
Or worse.
Right, yeah, for sure. It's been rewritten by Clooney and his regular writing partner, Grant Heslov, and I imagine updated to fit the times based on the way this film plays out. What did you think, Glenn?
Yeah, it's quite an interesting one. It stars a few interesting actors, Matt Damon, Julianne Moore as twins, under the Coen brothers of Nuts Innovation a few times, and Oscar Isaac in my favourite role in the film. It's set in the idyllic 50s, 60s, we're really not so sure, but there is an underbelly, there is a tragic event, as there is in many, many Coen brothers films, and it's very much more of the style of Fargo than some of his other ones. I have had very mixed feelings on this one. Panel, how do we feel about Suburbicon?
Yeah, mixed feelings sums it up. What's interesting about this film, I think it does have a genuinely interesting plot that had a lot of potential, which is that it's a typical Coen brothers story of corruption, but the innocent figure that's viewing it is a child. And the power dynamic between a child and corrupt, evil parents who are manipulating him is really interesting. But I think the movie is a little bit scattered. We'll get into that in a bit, because I could rant about that all day. So it doesn't capitalize on that material as well as it could have.
Exactly. I think, in a way, the movie did have the consciousness of a child in the way it's scattered and trying to focus on things. It's trying to present so many ideas without doing any
Take
of them.
Take that,
any
George Clooney, you
justice.
Child.
Exactly. It is childish. It's a childish movie, actually, which has a center child as a protagonist, which is just, you know, how it is. But in a way, I think it's also a very Glenn-like movie. I thought it was set in the 50s.
The rivalry
and 60s.
Continues on.
It's, you know,
film
set in the
Fight
50s.
Club.
So you think Glenn and you think 50s, 60s, a striped suit and like very neat haircut. You should see my hair. It's nothing.
First of all, it's a very self-professed persona. I'm not making it up. It's you who like to actually put that on. So I'm just going by the flow, by what you would want to be seen as.
Oh, I don't know if I want to be seen it still. This isn't my favorite Coen Brothers movie. I like Hail Caesar. I like to Brother Out now. But if you're going to compare me to one, dude, Fargo, you know, one of the classics.
I mean, I know it's Fargo, definitely, but this
wood
movie
chipper.
Is...
You okay. Do own a wood chipper.
Richard, we're live, man.
I mean, all right. Fargo, definitely, but this movie is far gone.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. All right.
Oh, yeah. How long have you been working on that one for?
Okay.
All of 2 seconds.
My problem with this movie, I have a lot of problems, but, okay, two major ones. The first is that this movie doesn't have enough of its own identity. It feels way too indebted to the Coen brothers. And the obvious response to that is, well, duh, it's a Coen brothers script. But it goes further than that in the way that George Clooney's direction has clearly tried to ape the Coen brothers at every turn. The score is by Alexandre Desplat, but it's really evoking the kind of cartoonishness of some of Carter Burwell's scores for Coen brothers comedies, but in a way that feels kind of tone deaf. The Coen brothers would nail this material because they created this style of film. And Clooney doesn't really feel confident here. It goes into, as you say, the device of having the same actor playing twins borrowed from the Coen brothers, the casting choices, putting Oscar Isaac. I'm not sure if they've actually been in Coen brothers movies. I haven't done the research enough to say
Julianne
that definitively.
Moore has,
Julianne Moore has, exactly. But I was going to say the character actors who play the two Coen-like mob figures in this and the way they're shot, the wide-angle, low-angle close-ups of them that make their faces look really grotesque and distorted are so, so clearly trying to ape what the Coen brothers would have done with this visually back in, like, 1995. Mm. It's a movie that feels really dated.
But it's 2017, so this movie just feels like shit.
Yeah. Can't say that on radio.
No. If I can chip in here, I'm waiting to hear something that I disagree with. I'm completely conscious of the fact that this is film Fight Club.
Right.
And so this is where I'm waiting for Glenn's 50s to kick into gear so we can actually argue about something.
That's why we just fight each other.
All right. I'll defend this film. There's one thing I really loved about it, and that was Oscar Isaac, and he was absolutely incredible.
Yeah, the movie could have been about his character, as we discussed after the screening.
I totally watched the spin-off.
Yeah, Glenn was right.
100% I'd watch that spin-off.
But what really got me about this film, and I enjoyed some aspects of it, but the fact was, in every Coen Brothers film, there's some underlying social tension, some giant social movement or change that is happening, and that was very present here, literally next door, but it did not integrate into the film
I had a major problem with this, because this movie delves into imagery of white mobs, you know, yelling at black people, racial harassment, waving the Confederate flag.
Which is where your 2017 comes into it.
Yeah,
right there.
Exactly. Yeah. I really wonder if that was added by Clooney and Heslov in the recent rewrite, or if that was part of the initial draft. But the problem is that those images have power, right? I feel like if you're going to put that in your film, you have to treat it really seriously. But all that it amounts to in this movie is a subplot that... it's less than a subplot because all it's really used to do is to create a major event later in the movie that explains why police don't intervene in the climax of this film.
Yeah, and look, I've agreed with everything you've said completely, and I absolutely think you bang on the money with this film. But the one thing you said at the top was that it is glimpsed through the eyes of a child. And so maybe, I don't know, giving this film the benefit of the doubt, this is, you know, a child's point of view trying to comprehend this complex sort of network of, you know, this is how race relations work, this is how parental relationships
That's interesting.
How parental relationships work. Yeah.
That's interesting.
I agree, but also in doing that, it treats the audience like a child, which I felt a bit...
No, I agree with you.
...cheated by
I
that.
Agree with you, but I'm trying to be kind.
No, I think what Richard has said is where the film had potential to be really good. If the racial element could have justified its inclusion if there'd been more of a direct parallel to going on about this is the injustice of the world, which is, I think, what they were trying to do, but it's kind of thematically confused and it doesn't, you know, it feels like that stuff is just a like excess fat hanging off the movie, except it's, you know, something that serious and images that have that much power to traumatize people, you know, shouldn't be used
window
as like the
dressing.
Excess as window dressing.
Yeah.
Actually, on a broader thematic level, it's interesting to know there have been so many political movies as such, to use the term, because 2017 is the year of political movies. And yet, how many movies have actually done the political subplot or the political theme justice?
Well, there's one we'll be talking about next week, Detroit.
Which does, interestingly, but I think a great article I read about this film, Suburbicons, made the point that any film that has to be made is greenlit and then done 2 years later. So by the time it's out, it's already kind of a little bit past. Detroit kind of actually does that quite well. We will discuss that next week, but this, I think, was very much off the mark.
I agree, and I think there's bigger problems with this movie. Like, as I was saying earlier, the storyline's actually pretty good and has quite a lot of potential to be really interesting, but... You know, it does feel dated in that we've seen these kinds of Coen comedy setups before. So whenever there's a joke being set up, you can see it a mile away. Things like a really funny turn with Oscar Isaac's character is so, you know, it's been done much.
The little vignettes. I mean, the bit that's in every piece of promotional material is him on the bicycle trying to run away from this fire. And that's hilarious. And it works in the trailer. And if there are a few more of those and it wasn't at the centerpiece of everything you've already seen about the film, you probably could enjoy this a little bit more.
So basically, Clooney should stick to acting rather than directing.
Well, maybe. Look, there's funny stuff potentially in it, but it always misses the mark. But one thing that I thought was just terrible in this movie was the introduction, which goes over this welcome to this pretty little 50s town. And it's so played out now. It's like we've seen Pleasantville, you know, we've seen Blue Velvet, we've seen Edward Scissorhands. It's just rehashing that 50s nostalgia parody thing that is... way past its use by date in 2017. Like, we know the 50s were bad. Tell us something about why they were, instead of just, people were racist and white and everything was boring. All right, whatever.
Until you mentioned that, it had completely left my mind that was the top of the film.
Yeah.
And it does set the tone for something that doesn't actually pay off later.
Thank God.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because that would have been... I was dreading what kind of movie we'd be about to watch. But
exactly.
If you're
going to
go there...
Can you imagine that film? Can you imagine the events of that film set... purely in that sort of fantasy version of the 50s. I think that could have been
interesting. You're right. Yeah. If it had stuck to this plot.
Stepford Wives 2.0.
Yeah.
So that is Suburbicon. Very mixed feelings on that one. But it will be in cinemas tomorrow. We'll be back talking about The Green Arrow with Richard. Stay tuned. And that was the theme from The Green Arrow. Wow, what a theme. It's
Arrow.
I always say arrow and I immediately sound like, you know, Scooby-Doo's just asked a question. Arrow?
My name is Oliver Queen.
Yeah, I know. I was waiting for the whole, my name is Oliver Queen, I spent 5 years on an island. I was waiting for that to come in. It's like, I can't, this Pavlovian response I have now.
What happens now? There's this other audio that's just dropped in. But we will get to the island.
We'll
get to that because we are talking about The Green Arrow. And Richard, wow, you've done an amazing job. This book, I've just read it. It is really great. You've put so much effort and research into it. Dude, good on you. As you said earlier, thanks. Richard is a world expert on The Green Arrow. And the first question I want to ask you on a very broad level, because it is the question you pose in the opening line of the book, and there are many answers because he is a journalist and, as I learned, a florist and all these other many sorts of things. Who is Green Arrow?
It's a good question. You should buy the book. And
already plugging material in the first bit.
No, look, Green Arrow is one of those characters who, for a long time, and as you pointed out, he's got a TV show now, one of four or five, and he really kicked off the on the CW network in the US. He really kicked off the new sort of wave of superhero television shows. But Green Arrow's been one of those characters who's been around since the 1940s, and maybe he hasn't had as much love as, you know, Superman and Batman and Wonder Woman and contemporaries like that. But he's always been there. When I started writing this book, he was about 74 years old, and I intended this to come out in the 75th anniversary, which was last year, but publishing patterns being what they were, it didn't happen until this year.
It's okay. I don't think anybody actually realized that it was the 75th anniversary, except you. So it still works, you know.
It's part of the thing. You know, this is a character who has literally been in continuous print for 75 years, and he's a huge part, clearly, because he's got a TV show, a huge part of the DC universe, and he's been everywhere, and no one had done this before, and I figured someone was going to do it, so it may as well be me.
Absolutely. Now, you've said to me that Green Arrow is your favorite. There's several people in the book who say that Green Arrow is their favorite. You obviously have a very clear dedication to the character. Before we get into the details of the book, how did you start this fascination with the Green Arrow?
Well, I mean, this will date me immediately. I started reading comics back in the 90s when I was in my mid-teens, I guess, early teens, really.
Still don't look a day older. I mean, look at you.
I know.
Fantastic.
I don't look a day over 60, right? And but like Ollie Queen, I've got a beard. It was just a character. I sort of started reading comics during that era when they were killing off superheroes left, right, and center. And Superman just died. That was huge. And in fact, I think I bought that issue about three shops down from where we're recording this now. There was a comic book store that's not there anymore in Sydney. You know, Batman had his back broken by Bane. The Green Lantern was, you know, killed off and replaced with someone new. And yet still somehow I retained a sort of trace memory of this character all the way up until when Kevin Smith reintroduced the original Oliver Queen in the early 2000s. And part of his run was looking back at the history of the character. And I think that was the seed. That's the sort of secret origin of this book. It was me then, from that point, going back and finding out as much as I could about this character. And I guess, you know, you could say that the research for this book took anywhere between 3 years and 15 years that I've been reading.
What do you think the Green Arrow actually stands for? Because people often have specific ideas of what Superman stands for, Batman stands for, Wonder Woman stands for. What Green Arrow, I mean, he's a bit of a, you know, what does he actually stand for?
Well, look, for a large part of the career, and there are a number of different versions of Green Arrow that have been around, but I think the thing that's certainly been true of him, he was very much a very famous writer in comic book circles, Denny O'Neill, called a blank slate. tabula rasa right up until the 50s and 60s.
That's Latin, by the way, for
that's
our
Latin.
Listeners.
I come in, I keep it classy. I just class the place up a little bit, you know. I write a book and I throw some class in there as well. No, you know, and he was very much a blank slate until the late 60s when they made him the political conscience, the political voice of the DC Universe, and he was the angry left voice who would literally stick it to the gods and say, you know, when you talk about the gods, you talk about in terms of Superman, Green Lantern, Wonder Woman, people who had powers beyond mortal man. And he was there going, well, the little people have problems too, and we should probably look after them. And there's this famous run that they did where he and Green Lantern just took off across America and tried to solve the world's problems. And they tackled everything from race relations to poverty to, you know, class warfare and drugs. It's a very famous issue where he finds out that his ward, Speedy, is a junkie. It's that's the language of the cover. And his name is Speedy. I mean, you know, he probably indicated early on. But, you know, and to me, that's Green Arrow. That's been the voice of Green Arrow for so long. He is the conscience of the Justice League.
Now, it's interesting you've said that because in the 60s, as I've read, he was the left-wing conscience. But then when you got into the 80s and the 90s with Alan Moore, and it was Chuck Dixon.
Yes.
He was quite an interesting character. He had quite a few choice comments in your interview, which I read in the book. The character changed quite rapidly. And how do you feel he's evolved in this sense over so many decades?
Well, there's two things there. Certainly Mike Grell, who wrote the character in the 80s, and he's the version of the character that gets most used these days. Certainly the version of the character they use in the TV show is based on Mike Grell's. This is very dark, post-Frank Miller, Dark Knight Returns, post-Watchmen version of Green Arrow, who is just this really, you know, they called him the urban hunter because he's in Seattle now. He's in a real city. He's wearing, you know, he's waterproof. He's got the hood. This is when the hood comes in,
yep.
Which is very much part of the TV show. And he's, you know, he's taking no prisoners. He is, you know, this dark. He's now in his 40s. He's, you know, lived a lot, and he's not the angry voice. He's still angry, but he's not, you know, the young guy that he once was anymore. So that becomes part, and he starts leaning a lot more. He starts leaning right, not completely, you know, conservative the way that, you know, a character like, say, the Punisher, who could have came in around the same era.
Frank Miller's Batman.
You know, he's not doing that. Like, we all know the Punisher shoots first and asks questions later. We know Frank Miller's Batman is, you know, about as right as they come. You know, yeah. That's very much
disciplinarian, you know, authority.
That crypto-fascist sort of character that Frank Miller created. Green Arrow's not quite there. And then Chuck Dixon, who you mentioned, is notoriously right-wing in his politics. Mm-hmm. And he does like to say that he keeps his politics and his comic books as separate as possible.
Which is impossible.
But at the same time, his version of Green Arrow is actually a completely different Green Arrow. It was the sort of successor version. It was a guy named Connor Hawke, who is the son of Green Arrow, basically, when it was like hot to do the son of characters during the 90s, you know. Yes.
It's telling that the sort of uber-left social politics version of Green Arrow kind of didn't have the panache, and you needed that kind of right-wing disciplinarian, you know, that kind of version to kind of actually get some gravitas in, be like, you know.
Yeah, it's funny.
Make it sexy again, because the left-wing character almost feels like, too vanilla.
It's funny because they brought him in when, like, in the late 60s, early 70s, when that politics was really hot at the time, and, you know, that was, they thought this would appeal to hot college kids.
Yeah, of course, left-wing politics appealing to hot college kids.
Yeah.
we are UCS, dude.
And the thing is, though, it was really critically acclaimed. Like, and this is one of the first comic books to get released in those, like, those paperbacks that you get. I'm making the thing like radio. I'm making the shape like radio. Yeah, people can see this. But you know those cheap paperbacks that you got in airport spinner racks, yep, and stuff like that. It was one of the first comic books for that to happen. It was really like critically
damn
acclaimed.
All those cultural Marxists buying Green Arrow. Gosh.
So it was out there and people were reading it, but like it wasn't, you know, being read, you know, widely. And the series got cancelled. The funny thing is that version of the character has remained the quintessential version of the character for a lot of people. In fact, when they've rebooted the character recently, that's what they've come back to.
It's ironic because people, that's what people say about left-wing politics. It's critically acclaimed, but doesn't work because it's not popular. So, well...
So what you're saying is the history of Green Arrow is the history of left-wing politics.
Pretty much.
I reckon I could sell this to UTS.
Oh, I think you could.
Well, you are a librarian, so you are the
left. True. That is true.
You left.
Politics and the Green Lantern could be a course. You could teach it.
I think there is a book called Green Lantern and Philosophy. So there's two textbooks right there.
I recently bought the Blackwell Pop Culture Philosophy series, and they had the Wonder Woman in Philosophy as the latest edition, which was fantastic.
That just came out.
Yeah. I know, and oh god, blew me away really in different directions.
They're a really great series, that actually. Yeah.
Now, there's a number of different versions of the character you go through, not just political. What I found really interesting was your commentary on how Green Arrow became the everyman, as many superheroes do.
Yeah.
And the college kid, there was one bit about how he had to become a vegetarian in order to stay in college or to afford college.
So we could afford, yeah.
Yeah. So
it was cheaper.
So he's just like us. I want to...
Trust me, as someone who's been vegetarian for 18 years, it's not cheaper.
Okay, you heard it here first.
Well, thank God he didn't become vegan. So,
yeah, well.
No, always a plus point.
So what is this version of the character? And at the same time, all Batman, some of my favorite superheroes, we know them as everyday jocks. Spider-Man 2, obviously, it is Marvel.
Mm. Batman is an everyday jock. He's a billionaire.
Okay, not Batman. But there have been versions. What is your special power? He's rich.
He's rich.
So what is the appeal behind Green Arrow, this billionaire, suddenly becoming the everyday dude? Why did this happen?
I reckon it's because he was still flying under the radar. Like, this is a character who didn't have his own book, despite the fact that he was created in 1941 and pretty much in continuous print. He didn't have his own book, like his own like headline title, until the 80s. So they just had the freedom to do whatever they wanted with him in the background of these characters. So he was a moving target. He was exactly a moving target.
I see. It makes sense.
You've read the cover of the book.
I do say it's got some particularly great cover art. It's pretty spectacular.
I want to go shout out for the cover art. The cover art is done by a guy named Louis Joyce, who is almost Wollongong based artist. Not quite Wollongong, but I've known him for a number of years, and he was actually one of the first people I thought of when I wanted to get some cover art happening. And look, he's just—I hope people judge this book
by
his cover.
It's fantastic. Shout out to Louis, fantastic work. You know, if I ever do get published, you know, I'm reaching out to you.
There you go. You got another commission there. Louis. Yeah.
Fantastic. One other really interesting thing you interrogate in the book is how some of the female characters are written and how some of them evolved over many years.
Yeah.
And there was a really interesting comment by one of the interviewees where he said some comic book writers find it difficult to, and correct me if I'm wrong, write male and female characters who aren't married or haven't been sketched.
I think that was Mike Grell said that, yeah.
Yes. And I found that really interesting because obviously his relationship with Dinah changes over the course of many years. His relationship with the main character in the show changes over many years too. And I'm wondering how you felt this has been... maybe bettered or different, maybe changed in the later issues of Green Arrow, or how you see this reflected in comic books generally?
It's really interesting because I think there is that temptation to marry. There's the moonlighting syndrome, right? So, like, as soon as you pair off a character, you kind of take something away from them necessarily, and that's where Green Arrow and Black Canary kind of stand out, that they were a couple, warts and all. They fought, they fell out, they made up, they made love over the course of, 40, 50 years. And they're still doing it. And I think that makes them quite distinct. Unlike Lois Lane and Clark Kent, you know they're going to be together. It's a little bit more volatile with these guys. It's a real relationship, I think.
It definitely is in the show. And speaking of the show, many FIP readers, myself included, will know Green Arrow first and foremost through the show. And there's only one iteration of the character. I learned through the book that the hook of the show, the island that he has founded in the very first episode, is only introduced 20 years into his run, much later. So how did you feel the show adapted what a character you've watched and seen grow over literally decades and decades?
It's really weird. When the show first came out, I guess 6 years ago, because we're just into season six now, I didn't know quite what to believe. I could see the influences there, but this is a character who was killing people in the first season. Oh, that's not my Ollie. And it's very much influenced by, at the time it was very much influenced by the Christopher Nolan Dark Knight films. You could see that influence there. Mm-hmm. Most of the villains, some of the storylines were taken straight out of Batman books. So it was a really interesting move, and cynically some people say it was because they couldn't quite do Batman. They weren't allowed to do Batman on television. So we got Green Arrow in doing Batman stories on television. the show's evolved a lot more since then, and it's taken on its own identity. Because I don't think they know quite what they're doing with Batman on the big screen now. So they've
We're all a little concerned. Yeah.
Sad flag.
I'm not too concerned. Do we need more Batman? I reckon he's played out for now.
Yeah.
I reckon give Batman another 10-year retirement like he had after Batman and Robin, right? That guy's overexposed.
I want the animated series to come back
because the Dark Knight can return. Oh wait,
fond memories.
The Batman the animated series was fantastic.
God. That's my first sort of adult kind of cartoon memories, actually.
Yeah, for me too. I mean, that kind of era, those 90s, the Batman animated series, there was a Spider-Man animated series,
X-Men.
And X-Men. Mm-hmm. I'm now going to have that theme stuck in my head for the rest of the night. It's again, it's Pavlovian.
We have our jukebox right here, Bharat.
We should just form an a cappella group and go on the road.
No.
We've already done our film karaoke club.
We do enough a cappella on the show as is.
Pitch Perfect 4, I'm asking right now, Universal.
Yeah, we can do the we can flip the all-female reboot thing and do an all-male reboot of Pitch Perfect, which is about four film nerds.
I think that'd just be the status quo, actually. I think that's not a flip. Right. They just have default four male guys anyway.
Struggling to get their voices out there on Sydney-wide radio.
Yep.
Acapellaing every week after they've sold the show to the station as a film talk program.
Yeah, struggle is real.
Why did you say this live? They'll know now.
Yeah, second act conflict.
We mentioned films.
Yeah, second act conflict where the station bosses listen to an episode and are like, what the hell?
Yeah.
This isn't what we were told.
We just sang the film Fight Club theme last time.
It was a two and a half men thing.
So
that's true.
Yeah.
Now we have the new Justice League movie coming up, as we said.
We do.
Green Lantern and Green Arrow. They're friends. Green Lantern has had an adaptation. Green Arrow has not. Can we see maybe a crossover? Can we see a Green Arrow movie in the future? What do you think of the prospects for this?
Look, there was a Green Arrow movie in the works for the longest time. It was called Supermax. I can't remember who was attached to be in it, but it was basically the premise was he's Green Arrow at the start of the movie. He gets thrown in jail for a crime that he didn't commit. And
they haven't happened before.
No, never. And then he has to work with all the villains and like everyone from like the Joker to Harley Quinn, you know, all that sort of stuff, to get out of prison. And it's a kind of cool idea. It wouldn't have been quite the Green Arrow movie I wanted. If that was going to be the one shot at Green Arrow, it wouldn't have been the movie I wanted to see. So I'm glad they did a TV show. I think it's unlikely we're going to see him on the big screen anytime soon because, frankly, I don't think the DC Extended Universe knows what it's doing right now.
Nope.
I think we'll be lucky to see the films that they've announced at this point.
Actually, do you think Marvel knows what it's doing with its universe?
Yes.
I think they know exactly what they're doing, and because we're Disney in charge of it now, they know exactly
what's
going to make money. They got demographics on that stuff. They got analytics out.
They have it locked down.
Oh, God. Yeah. What are your metrics for this movie?
They've got it planned out till 2028, I think they said.
I wonder if it can last that long because I know...
I was talking to someone about this yesterday.
I'm the worst person to talk about this because since like 2003, I've been like, people are going to get sick of these superhero movies, you know, any time now. But I think the thing that's kept Marvel going is that they renew your interest with new hooks and new concepts.
Yeah.
And... What can you do that's new after you've done Thanos? Like, that is such a massive scale event.
This
I can't
is the
see
weird
them topping
thing.
That.
Like, this is the weird thing with him. I mean, somebody said, you know, it was analogous to Westerns, you know, that Westerns were the biggest thing in the movie universe during the 40s and 50s, and then they just went away, and you get a few of them every now and then. I think the difference is with superhero movies, they're not just... A homogenous genre, you know. You can get
Westerns had a fair bit of variation in them too, though.
They did. But I think, particularly the Marvel superhero movies, you have seen everything from flat out comedies to Cold War spy thrillers and so forth. So I think there's a bit of variation. I think the bubble's got to burst really soon.
I do too. Yeah. So, I think they've run out of ways you can veer away from the formula.
So the book is Moving Target, The History and Evolution of Green Arrow. Richard, where can you buy it?
You can buy it pretty much anywhere good books are sold, but I would recommend getting on Amazon if you can get it because it'll be the cheapest and quickest way to get it here in Australia. Otherwise, go to the official website for the publisher, which is sequart.org. That's sequart.org.
Fantastic. So that was Richard Gray from The Real Bit. Please do seek out the book. It is fantastic. It is a wonderful read. And it's in Richard's wonderful conversational style, so it's a very easy-flowing, fun thing to go through chapter by chapter. So, yes, please do seek it out.
Also, thank you, Richard, for inscribing my book, which is really cute.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I wrote it to my biggest fan. Absolutely. As I know you are. You're a big supporter, man.
So we're almost out of time. We just want to tell you about a couple of amazing things that happened this week. The new Palace Cinemas is open in Central Park. It looks amazing. Please do check it out. At the Ritz, they are doing a Paul Thomas Anderson series of all
Hard 8
films.
On Sunday.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
That's very worth seeing. The Orpheum have the Australian premiere of The Disaster Artist, the film based on The Room, and the last screening of The Room before that on the first Monday of November. I've got my tickets and I'm pretty damn excited.
Terrence Malick.
The British Film Festival has just started. That is playing at Palace Cinemas around the state. And at Broadsheet, have advertised the film Darlinghurst Film Club's monthly screenings the last Thursday of every month, which is Terrence Malick's Real Version of the New World.
So, which is my favourite film. Go and see Chris Evans' favourite film tomorrow at QT Sydney.
Also, Glenn is braving that movie, so I feel really, really sorry for him.
So, Richard, thank you so much for coming on. It was Richard Gray from The Real Bits, and we'll be back next week. Good night.